I had heard about your opening article, that I Was a Playboy Bunny, for many years, but I had never had a chance to read it, and of course I enjoyed it. How did it feel after all of these years writing for Miz and being as involved in various activities as you are, to suddenly dredge up this very famous article and all of a sudden it's back again?
It was a strange sensation because I had been very sorry I wrote it for many years. It was what you might call a career error of gigantic proportions. I had just begun to get a few serious assignments, which was then even more difficult in general, and maybe for women freelancers especially, than it is now. The minute I wrote this, then suddenly all the suggested assignments I got were that I should pretend to be a hooker on 42nd Street, or I should commit myself to a mental institution, and so on. And though it's true that that's in the great tradition of Nellie Bly and of journalism, it was the only kind of suggestion I got for a very long time, so that after this piece appeared and I saw the response to it, I quickly gave back the book advance that I had accepted to expand it into a book, and just generally tried to forget about it, and was not so happy to find myself introduced as a bunny all the time, you know, for years afterwards. And it was only dawning feminism, I guess, that made me understand that we're all bunnies in a way, I mean, you know, and that it was a legitimate journalistic enterprise to expose what their working conditions were and how women were treated, and that it was in a way a microcosm of the society. Mm-hmm. So I didn't feel nearly as bad going back to read it as I had after I wrote it.
But it wasn't really a career setback, was it?
Oh yes,
it was.
It was a disaster. Because I kept getting the wrong kinds of assignments then. Yeah, I was typecast.
You wanted to focus on political reporting to a degree, I would assume. Much of your book deals with the impressions with McGovern and others. So is that what you wanted
mm-hmm.
to do?
Yes, I wanted to write about what I was interested in and what I was working on anyway as a volunteer and, you know, outside of my professional life, and that was politics. But there weren't so many women who were political reporters then, pretty few really. And if you're a freelance writer, you mostly got assignments on food and fashion and the wives of politicians, not the politicians themselves. It wasn't until New York Magazine started that I began to actually find that my interests and my work life were coinciding.
Did you consider yourself a feminist at the time that you did the Playboy article?
No. I'm not sure I knew what feminism was. I mean, I had one sentence in my textbook somewhere in the past that said women were given the vote, thus was 150 years of struggle summed up. I mean, I'm sure I had all the images of blue stockings and strangeness, or at best I thought it was all finished, it was all won, and that if I was still having a lot of difficulty, it must be my personal fault.
But I think it's fair to say that people characterize you today as a feminist writer. Is that correct?
I hope so. Yes, I hope so.
Why couldn't a writer be as eclectic as possible and write not only about feminism, but all other aspects of people's lives? Of course, in many respects, you do. There's no, mm-hmm. there's no question about that. As a matter of fact, my favorite article was the memoir that you wrote about your mother. And so I perhaps my question was filled with too many assumptions.
Yeah, you can. I mean, I think that being a feminist means that you see the world whole instead of half. It shouldn't need a name. And one day it won't. One day it'll just be being a journalist or a writer.
Had you, as a child in Toledo, had any inkling of what you wanted to do as an adult?
No. Well, I wanted to get out of Toledo. That was clear to me. And I ate, slept, and breathed getting out of Toledo. And the only way I thought I was going to do it was by being part of show business in some way, because I think show business is to women of all classes what sports is to men and boys in poor neighborhoods. It's where you see someone who looks like you who's doing something different. And so I misplaced my ambitions and entered the Ted Mack Amateur Hour and tried to tap dance my way out of Toledo. That was the only thing that I saw. But that was the only possible future I could imagine, other than going to work for the gas company and marrying somebody who worked in one of the assembly lines in a local plant.
What influence did Smith College have in your future?
Interesting question. I'm not sure. Well, it got me out of Toledo, A, number one. And it opened my horizons to the world in many ways. But I'm sorry to say not in others, because it was the 50s, and we were still being educated to be mothers, as they pointed out. You know, we must educate women so we have educated children, and the wives of executives, and so on. I don't mean that this was uniformly true, but it was sort of the prevailing wind of, you know, of the place in those years. I suppose most places. They were still bragging that they had four times more male faculty than female faculty. And we were still learning to be intellectual ornaments. And we were not learning about anything that had to do with women's own status in society. I understand, I'm told now that they had feminist books in the library, and they were locked up in the rare book cage because they were so little used. But I suppose in some ways it opened up the world, and in other ways I've spent the subsequent 25 years getting over my education.
Was the Playboy piece your first published article?
No. My first signed published article was in Esquire, and it was called Betty Coed and the Contraceptive Revolution or something. I don't know. It was an early article about the contraceptive pill and its social impact. And it was actually in the 50th anniversary issue of Esquire that recently came out.
They repeated it?
Yes. They reran it.
How did that come about, your initial article for Esquire?
Well, I came to New York, and I was working a couple of days a week for Harvey Kurtzman, who is a satirist who invented Mad Magazine and so on. And he had invented yet another magazine called Help, a political satire magazine. So I was working for him, and really there are only three of us doing this magazine, which means that you learn a lot about magazines. I mean, you learn more than you ever wanted to know about.
Were you a writer on the magazine? Or?
I was in everything. I was a gopher, a writer, a caller-up of celebrities to get them on the cover, arranger of photography sessions, and everything, because there literally were only three of us on the whole magazine. And because that was part of the magazine world, albeit a small part, I came to know people from other magazines, including Esquire. I wrote some unsigned pieces for Esquire, what to do on dates in New York, and how to cook without really cooking for men. I mean, you know, all kinds of frivolous but funny things. And then they were doing their annual campus issue, and I did an outline for the issue. Because I was somewhat closer to campus than most of the editors were. And they liked a lot of the pieces in the outline, including two that were by me. One was called The Student Prince, How to Succeed, Though an Undergraduate, a kind of funny Machiavellian guide. How to Seize Power, Though an Undergraduate. And the other one was about the contraceptive pill. And Clay Felker was my editor then, who a number of years later started New York Magazine, where I also worked.
So it was Harvey Kurtzman and Clay Felker who gave you the entree into writing. Did you say that?
Yeah, I think so. Especially Clay, who really gave me my first assignment.
When did it occur to you that you wanted to focus on more serious writing?
Well,
Or was this a gradual thing?
Well, let's see. I mean, before that, I had lived in India for a couple of years. And while I was there, I was writing, and I was experiencing, I mean, learning a lot, discovering that this country is not the norm in the world, that, in fact, it is the exception, and discovering how the rest of the world lives, and ending up accidentally walking through vast areas in which there had been caste riots and so on. I mean, I came back from India wanting to write about those things, but there was very little interest in India at that point. You know, people went to sleep when you started to talk about India. And this
they
is
still
19,
do.
Well, this is 1958. I mean, it was, you know, much, much worse. And also, I was a very unknown writer. So I came back, you know, full of idealism and energy. I must have been very tough to get along with. I mean, because I just discovered poverty, and I thought somehow that the world was couldn't go on like that. You know, I mean, I didn't realize it had been going on for thousands of years with just this kind of injustice. But gradually I gave that up because there was no place to put it. There was no place to write about it. It was like a black hole in my life. Nonetheless, the piece about the contraceptive pill was a serious piece of journalism, and it was that that was beginning to bring me serious assignments. Also, I was then freelancing for Show magazine, a now defunct but a very beautiful arts magazine of the 60s. And I was just beginning to get serious assignments. Much of the success of a woman freelancer depends on staying out of the office. Because once you get into the office, they start asking you to answer the phone and do their typing. So as long as I was sort of staying out of the office and just handing in manuscripts, I was okay. But the problem with the Bunny piece was that it not only blended the person and the writing, but it blended it in a certain stereotyped way.
Presumably, you were making enough of an income to survive during these years, because freelancing is not an easy job.
Well, you might call it survival. I spent a lot of time sleeping on the living room floors of my friends. I think the first year I freelanced, I made about something between $2,000 and $3,000. But
they're still making that much.
I think I was lucky because I happened to have a father who was freelance everything. I mean, he had 2 points of pride. He never wore a hat and he never had a job, by which he meant that he was always his own boss and he, you know, didn't bow to convention. So he had taught me to live with insecurity, because that's the way we always lived. And indeed, I even liked it. I mean, the idea that you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow can become as important as that you do know what's going to happen tomorrow. Because if you don't know, it could be wonderful. So I was very temperamentally well-suited to freelancing.
Tell me a little bit about your mother's influence on you, because the article that I liked very much was the one about your mother, and this was extremely poignant. I felt very emotional about that. And tell me a little bit about your mother and what all that meant to you.
You know, you're very nice to say that, because I've gotten, you know, very good personal response to it, and especially from women, but also from men. But the other day a man did ask me if I was worried that her illness was hereditary, and suddenly I realized that not all readers got it. I guess her influence on me is more in the absence of her accomplishment and what she could have been than in its presence. For many years she was an invalid. She was very depressed and, I suppose, somewhat physically ill, but mostly mentally ill. And she was just somebody to be taken care of. I didn't understand who she was or that she was a real person. And only after I was in college and she was in a mental hospital did I really meet her for the first time. Suddenly there, this person emerged from the non-person, you know, she was funny and smart, and she had been a newspaper reporter long before I was born, and she loved it, and she wanted to, and she was good at it. She used to write under a man's name for years because she couldn't get published under her own name, and ultimately became Sunday editor of the Toledo Blade, which was, I think, a very unusual position for a woman. But she had to give that up and give up her dreams of traveling and having a life of her own, not because my father was a bad person, he was a very nice person, but because that's the way the world ran. So he wanted to go to an obscure rural spot in southern Michigan and start a summer resort, and she felt she had to go with him, and also she had my sister to look after. This is all before I was born. So I didn't meet the real person until I was a grown-up.
You had a lot of reconstruction to do, didn't you?
This is sort of like a mystery story, you know, and that's the sadness, because you understand, or you wonder, you know, what she could have been.
We're almost out of time, but I had one or two other questions I wanted to ask you. How did the Ms. magazine come about? Because as I recall, it was an offshoot from, it was an insert in New York Magazine, mm-hmm. as I recall, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Well, we had, once the sort of contagion of the women's movement began, the ideas and the excitement, and I could not write about it for the magazines I was already writing for because they were not interested, or they said, well, if you're going to write one piece about saying women are equal, then to be objective, we'll have to publish one next to it saying they're not equal, you know. So I had begun to go out and do something very unnatural to me, which is to speak in public. And from that traveling, I realized that there was an audience for a different kind of magazine, as many other women who were traveling also realized. So a lot of us who were writers and editors or had had some publishing experience got together to start Ms. Magazine and tried very hard for about a year to raise money, and it was totally impossible. I mean, forget it. I mean, a magazine is hard enough, but a feminist magazine and, you know, one that's going to be controlled by its staff, I mean, you know, there was no luck. But fortunately, Clay Felker and New York Magazine needed something for their year-end issue. They did a big year-end double issue. And Clay said, okay, if you do the work for free, we'll publish a piece of this magazine, and we will then pay to have an additional number of pages printed and send out a sample issue of the separate magazine around the country, so you'll at least have a test issue. And it was this enormous success, just incredible, unforeseen success. We had no idea. I mean, I went to California after the first issue came out, which we had dated spring 1972, came out in January. I mean, we had visions that it was going to lie in the newsstands for ages, and we didn't want to embarrass the rest of the women's movement. I went to California to do talk shows and publicize it, as all the authors did, because we had no money for publicity. And someone called up in San Francisco and said, I can't find it. So I called Clay and said, Clay, it never got here. Disaster has struck. And it turned out it was sold out in 8 days.
Actually, it was a very good time for the magazine for a couple of reasons. One, it was coming in at about the same time the feminist movement was beginning to take off, and two, it came in at a time when general interest magazines were dropping like flies, where you are focusing on special interest magazines. So you were very lucky.
Yes, and that's true, special interest in the sense that it was doing something television wasn't doing. I mean, at that point, television was replacing general interest magazines and knocking them off. But I must say, it's still very difficult. It's a kind of 19th century business, magazines, you know, and the cost of paper and postage and everything has increased about 800% since we started, and we still promise more editorial than advertising, and we're a mostly text readers magazine, so... And we don't have a big parent, you know, that can plow money into us.
That's a good way of phrasing it. A 19th century industry, book publishing is that too, because you have to physically take something and have it printed and bound, mm-hmm. and then physically distributed.
Yes.
Where it's so much easier to broadcast or
exactly.
reach somebody's house directly in a variety of ways. So.
And when you have to do it once a month, all over the country, it's tough.
Most of your writing today appears in Ms.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I write just about every month for the magazine.
Well, obviously, I've been focusing on Gloria Steinem, the writer, and not the activist, because writing is something that I deal with in my series. So I'd like to ask you, you're such a good writer, but you have never, as far as I know, have written any fiction. Is that something that you might consider in the future?
Yes, maybe, but I think I've lost my old feeling that... poetry was better than novels. Novels was better than journalism. You know, that I used to have this hierarchy in my head of what was creatively and artistically worthwhile. Reality has gotten so interesting that fiction has taken a back seat a little bit, and I think that that's true for a lot of writers, because a lot of fiction writers have turned their fictional techniques, whether it's Capote or Tom Wolfe or whoever it is, or, you know, Joan Didion in a sense, or to real events. I'm interested in movies, because movies are mythic. They really enter our heads in a kind of Greek mythological way. And I would like to try to do that.
Movies? In what form?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I just see them in my head, so I thought I'd try to...
Write movies, you mean?
Yes, right. Mm-hmm. Yes, no, I can't imagine doing anything other than that, but I would like to try that.
It's not too late. You never know. This was your first book, wasn't it?
Yes, in 20 years. Isn't that... That's not good.
Well, it's when I saw that that it was your first book, I didn't believe it. I said, "Oh no, Gloria Steinem's been around writing for years. Must have a dozen books to her credit, and this was your very first."
Mm-hmm. And actually, if I had done an anthology 10 years ago, I would have. There's so much that was just completely out of date now that couldn't be used.
Well, one last question. Aside from the potential of some of making movies or writing movies, what's ahead for Gloria Steinem?
Good question, because if you'd asked me 10 years ago, I would have been totally wrong. At that point, I was saying, well, I'll work on the magazine for 2 years, tops. I'll give it 2 years. And now I realize that I'd be quite happy being at least in part there for the rest of my days. I mean, it's so varied and so interesting, and it has such impact. But I guess I would like to write more and talk less. Although I've come to understand there are some things you can do in lectures and on television you just can't do by writing. But in general, I'd like to write more and talk less. And I think I would like to keep working at Ms. And I would like to travel more internationally. I mean, I spend a lot of time wandering about, lecturing, organizing, whatever it is that I do in this country and a little bit in other countries, but especially in third world countries. Perhaps it's because India had such a big impact on me. And because I think that we have a lot to learn from the women in third world countries. In a sense, women are a third world wherever we are. You know, we're undercapitalized, we're labor rich, we're low on technology. And a lot of the models of progress in other countries are more appropriate than the one-person Horatio Alger model of progress that we have here.
I have to ask one final question. What are they saying about you back in Toledo, and do you ever get back?
Yes, I went back. I wrote a little bit about it in the book together with a chapter on a college reunion I went to because it was the very same summer. The interesting thing was, you know how they say you can't go home again? Well, you can go home again. And actually, you should go home again, because it turned out that this town out of which I had tried so desperately to get contained more women with more energy and smarts than Smith did, because they had to work. They didn't have an option. And if they'd gone to college, they'd gone with some difficulty and gone at night and so on. Whereas I don't mean to overgeneralize because there are many exceptions on both sides, but the women at Smith had been pressed by society to be dependent. They'd been married to some of the few men, you know, who could support a whole family. And they were much less self-confident. It makes me understand that we need a whole new class analysis to include the other half of the world, because we've wrongly supposed that women were the same class as their husbands or their fathers. And it's really not true. There are ways in which class works in reverse for women.
So women are not much different than in the Midwest, but about the town, are they ready to put up a sign underneath the city limit sign saying "Home of Gloria Steinem"?
Well, I don't know. There's still a large number of the older citizenry there, I'm told, are angry at me because I said that, I reported that I had been bitten by rats at one point in my childhood in this very bad neighborhood we lived in. And there's a whole bunch of folks who are very insulted by that. And they said there was absolutely not one rat in the entire city of Toledo. I don't know why they took it so personally, because there are rats in every city. But aside from those people, I really enjoyed going home, and I found lots of shared interests, and I could be perfectly happy for all the time I spent getting out of East Toledo. East Toledo, I mean, Toledo, as you know, is a very class-divided town. So what's in East Toledo is bad, and what's in West Toledo is not great, but it's not East Toledo. So when I was on television, one of the few, you know, kind of hostile people that you always get, called up after the television show and referred to me as a slut from East Toledo. Now, if somebody had called me that when I was living there, I would have just killed myself with shame, you know. But I suddenly realized it was really a terrific thing to be. I wouldn't mind having it on my tombstone, a slut from East Toledo. So I had to make a little company recently for, you know, minor purpose, and because of some television I'm doing, so I called it East Toledo Productions.
Good for you. Thank you very much.